I'm Lauren Henderson. It is a great pleasure to be here interviewing the illustrious Lindsay Davis. Not the only adjective, of course, that we could use to describe her. She herself describes herself as paranoid and secretive in the Falco Companion, which we'll get to. And I can tell you that Lindsay is also, as well as those, a bit of a mad magnet. We were out in Bristol, the waterfront, last night, and I have been out in Bristol several times by myself during this conference. And by myself, no young men came up to ask us how to get to Wetherspoons or the biker bars. But somehow, in the companionship of Lindsay, we were deluged. And all I can say is, if anyone fancies picking up a young man who wants to go to Wetherspoons after the gala dinner, take her by the arm and walk down the waterfront. No one's ever going to introduce you like that again. I'm quite proud of that.
Well, they might. You don't know. Maybe my whole life is like that.
On the waterfront, spent Lindsay Davis, a life spent on the waterfront. I can be the autobiography. It's very good. I'm sure that everyone knows who Lindsay is and what she's written, but I am just going to briefly say that she began writing about the Romans with The Course of Honour, which is a standalone book telling the real-life love story of the Emperor Vespasian and Antonia Kinis. Am I saying that?
Kinis.
Her best-selling mystery series, which I'm sure everyone has read, features laid-back first-century Roman detective Marcus Didius Falco, who in a Radio 4 Women's Hour poll was voted second sexiest fictional character after Rhett Butler. So pretty good company that I love from it. There are 20 books in the Falco series. And she followed that up with The Falco Companion. I don't know if fans of the series have that already. I absolutely loved it. It's a really wonderful way for an author who doesn't want to write an autobiography to write a memoir, come autobiography, come extensive guide to the books, and it's completely charming. And she's also written Rebels and Traitors, which is an enormous great novel about the English Civil War. And we'll be talking about all of those. And though I will take questions towards the end, we have discussed this, and Lindsay feels that if anybody has a real kind of burning question or something that's arising specifically out of what we're talking about, please put up your hand and don't feel that you have to wait till the end. So, I wanted to talk briefly first about The Course of Honour, which I loved and, as you know, made me cry. And she said that was soppy, but it did.
Makes me cry. And I know how it ends. So. The ending makes me cry more than anything else.
And you actually said, I've always known, you wrote in an email to me, I've always known I'll never write another book like that.
That's true.
Why is that?
Because, mainly because it's a really good, true story. I could not believe when I worked out what the story of Vespasian and Kindness really was, that it had never been made into a novel before. And as far as I know, 20 years later, I never have found in any dusty bookshops anything about them. It's just magical for a romantic novelist because you have two people who are in love in their youth but cannot get married. They are debarred by the law because Vespasian wants to be in the Senate and it was illegal for him, therefore, to marry Kynes, who was a freed slave. Then she watches him becoming famous and wonderful in the way that's classic to romantic novels about great men. And when they are both in their 40s, his wife has died and he is famous enough for him to say, well, stuff that, though he doesn't, of course, in the book, because I was a new writer and didn't use rude expressions in those days. But he comes back to her and moreover, she takes him back, which has always struck me as more interesting in a way than him coming back. It obviously was genuinely true love, which we don't necessarily associate with the Romans. And then they live together, come what may, until Nero is forced to commit suicide. And there's a tussle for who's going to be next emperor. And Vespasian, who's always been sneered at for being middle class and the son of a tax collector, which rather appealed to me because I was middle class and had been a civil servant. He is the winner in the tussle after the year of the four emperors. Three other claimants have fallen by the wayside. He wins, and everybody assumes because his political platform is what Margaret Thatcher taught us to call traditional family values, that he will then leave Kindness again. She must have assumed that, I think. He's away from Rome. He's in the east when his rise to emperor actually happens. They're parted. And then I wrote the scene where he comes back, and as we know historically happened, he says, "No, you're coming to the palace as well." So,
I wouldn't mind a follow-up book. I know. Why do you... So you won't write it again? It's because this particularly inspired you?
There's
because of
no story like it. That's why. I have,
so it's
however,
not that you wouldn't write a romantic novel if... Or romantic, it's historical as well, but...
I have done a bookending book already, which I've handed in to my editor, and which is not the same. I never like to write the same book over again because I would be bored, and I'm sure readers would. But my latest book, my next book, will be set in the reign of, the whole reign of, the Emperor Domitian, Vespasian's bad son, who I thought I didn't like and didn't want to write about. But that is the same sort of a book where he is not the hero because clearly he's a villain, but there are a hero and heroine who live through various upsets, watching what happens to Domitian. And
Lindsay did say to me last night, it's about the Praetorian Guard and a hairdresser. And for one minute, I thought it was actually a Praetorian Guard by day, but he was a hairdresser by night. So sadly, that is not. That's probably another.
It's too late. Another kind. Had you said that to me before I wrote it, that's how it would have been.
But email me before the next
one. Instead of that, they are lovers. Eventually, you know how I am with love stories. It takes them quite a long time, though not as long as in Rebels and Traitors, where there are 200,000 words before the hero and heroine even met. That is my outside. I don't think I could ever cap that.
And you didn't realise. We'll get to Rebels and Traitors. We'll do the Falco books, and which are actually 20 books of a wonderful love story, as well as, you know, being all different kinds of crime novels. And when I was rereading a lot of them and filling in the gaps of the ones that I hadn't read when I interviewed Lindsay a couple of months ago, what really struck me is how you try every different crime novel style that there is. There's a locked room mystery. I'm not going to, you know, give too much away in case people haven't read books or name them, but there's a locked room mystery, there's serial killer, you know, there are the great chase scenes. You've really kind of, with every book, you don't know what's going to come next.
Even police procedurals.
The whole bureaucracy, you know, the world of bureaucracy, which most people in ancient Rome would avoid tremendously, you enter with great relish. You've always trying something new. And yes. was that a conscious...
It is a conscious decision. Simply, I decided fairly early on that there would be every other book. Falco would be a classic pavement-pounding detective in Rome, doing what detectives in big cities do. But that, because the Roman Empire offered such wonderful opportunities for different backgrounds, in the books in between, he would go to a different province of the Roman Empire and I'd have a nice holiday there. And that started me thinking that I could do books that were a different one from another, because the foreign ones are more adventures than classic looking for a murder in a community stories. And eventually I decided I'd deliberately branch out into whatever took my fancy. And so I've done my Agatha Christie book and my Ed McBain books, probably more than one. I've enjoyed it. And it seems to me, when you have a series, people say, how do you sustain a series? You sustain it by making it interesting and not by writing exactly the same book 20 times over. There are authors, some of whom may even be at this convention, some of whom you almost certainly have read, who just give you the same book again and again. But that, I wouldn't ever finish it, and you wouldn't ever want to finish it either.
I think it's also because you have such a large and strong family at the centre of the books. You know, Helena is always, you describe her as his partner, and she is very much his partner in so many ways.
Yes.
And then there's this extended family. I think you said that you actually had 50 main recurring characters.
When I came to write The Companion, I decided I wasn't going to make it the sort of encyclopedia that lists every character who's ever in a Falco novel. I would just do the ones who appear in more than one book, and there were an enormous number. They're not all in every book. I have to prune them out and select for each book who that's going to be about. But when I started, it all goes back to one joke, really. Falco was a kind of Philip Marlowe figure, but he was Italian, and because I write what I hope are funny books to keep myself amused as much as anything, I thought that he had to have an enormous Italian family. And I gave him that in the first book, though I didn't really colour many of them in, apart from his mother, a much-loved character who I can never kill. And I said he had this huge other family. And as I went on, luckily, to write other books, I started to give them names and characters and realised I was writing a Roman soap opera about them. And also I very quickly found that readers actually were more interested in them than they were in anything else. And I liked doing it. So we found a happy medium that way. And then as the series developed, there were things that I wanted to do. I got tired of him being a lone private eye, even when he became a lone private eye who had a partner in Helena. And so there are books where he tries to work with other people and run a kind of detective agency. But because of my way of looking at things and his luck, everyone he chooses to work with is hopeless. They get worse and worse and worse as the books go along. That was huge fun to do, I have to say.
Do you, with Nemesis, and I don't know how many people here have read Nemesis, which is the latest Falco, and again, one doesn't want to give anything away for people who haven't read it, but there was definitely a feeling to me when I read it, this is book 20, that it is the end of something. It may be one door closing and another opening, you know, but he's, you know, it's certainly, we can say he's financially stable, the house is lovely, the family's good. He's very settled and stable, and he's not the young guy chasing to catch up and make money. And I could see it as being a point where you take a break and go, am I going to go on with this? Is Albia, the stepdaughter, perhaps going to start investigating? Do you have a clear idea in your head of what 21 or where? No.
No, I don't. And people have to understand that. I have always worked only one book ahead, if that. At the moment, I have no idea what my next book is going to be at all. But what I have found, first with Rebels and Traitors and then with the book I just finished, is that it is refreshing to me to sometimes have a break from Falco. I know this is heresy for Falco lovers, but when I did take my break for Rebels and Traitors and then wrote Saturnalia and Alexandria, I have to think, and Nemesis, I think they are better books because I had had a break.
And certainly in the keeping this series fresh, I mean, it's actually always, there's usually a panel at BatchaCon about keeping a series fresh, and I find it a very interesting subject because, as you say, there are a lot of people who get stuck in ruts. And the fact that you do have the huge family, the different characters, the long running, the inacrities, the thread that weaves its way in and out, and you always know that one's going to get to it.
Not anymore, not inacrity.
Right.
I am staggered by the fact you kill off someone who it's obvious you've written 19 books intending to kill him at the end of them. And people still write and say, he's not really dead, is he? He's going to pop up out of that sewer in due course. How could you kill him? He has such innate decency. This is the worst villain I've ever written. One thing an author has to understand is that what you write is not necessarily what people will get out of the book. They may enjoy it, but they may enjoy it for completely different reasons that stagger you.
And I think sometimes with readers as well, you have to trust an author that in order to keep it fresh, they are going to have to make changes. Characters do die. You know, the really good long-running series, you feel there is a sense of forward movement.
Children especially die in my books simply because there are too many of them. Apart from the fact that I do want to say that in Roman life, children died. They died before they were born, they died during birth, and so did mothers. And more Roman children died before they were five than survived past that age. And so I do, I genuinely, as a someone who's interested in history, I want to show that. But if you're trying to write a crime novel, you do not want your protagonist to have acres of children getting in the way.
I do sometimes feel you'd rather not have given them any children
I
at all.
I would rather not have given them any children at all, except that there are touching moments between Favco and his babies. He is such a family man when you get
there. He is. He's a big Italian family.
And that is part of being a Roman, of course, as well. It's not just that I like men who do actually work well with children. He is conscious of his persona as a Roman, although he derides it. But he knows what a good Roman is supposed to be. And therefore, he is going to be a family man. He is going to do his duty. Therefore, he will pursue right, even when the authorities don't want him to. And that is part of him being a private eye.
You've said that, I don't know if people know the sort of creation origin story of Falco, which is that the line pretty much popped into your head standing on the tube steps.
That's one of the creation origin stories, yes. And there are several.
And it was narrated by Falco. Oh, by the way, who's, I don't know if people probably know this anyway, but his working name, that the one of the ideas that Lindsay had kicking around was Mickey Spartacus. And there was a file. I got this, I know, it's really good, isn't it? I got that from the wonderful Falco Companion, which I cannot recommend strongly enough. That there was actually a folder.
There still is a folder.
But there is still a folder.
I was reading something in it only the other day. I cannot understand why publishers poo-pooed. In fact, my agent, before it even got to a publisher, said, no, you can't call him Spartacus.
But you did say to me in a previous interview that you didn't realise you were starting a series that was going to end up in 20 books or with a male protagonist, and that you might not have done it that
many,
way.
Mainly because if anybody here is trying to become a writer, I had written maybe five novel-length works before I got to write The Silver Pigs. I had had three shortlisted for the Georgette Heyer Historical Novel Prize and not win. We don't know, we can't remember who actually did win some of those times. One of them was The Course of Honour and one of them was The Silver Pigs. They were runners-up, but that was all. And so I felt I might never become an author at all. And if I did manage to sell The Silver Pigs, I didn't know that anybody would want another one. In fact, the editor who took it, who is still my editor, Oliver, took two. So from the moment I got anywhere, I knew it was a series. But when I wrote it, I could not dare to hope that I'd be writing anymore.
And you thought that Helena was going to be the baddie. She was going to be the femme fatale, wasn't she?
So this goes back to, do you have a synopsis, Lindsay? Not in those days. I started on page one and wrote until I thought I'd done enough, really.
I didn't outline at all at my first seven. My mysteries, I never outlined. And I look back and think, that was insane. But mysteries, in a way, is easy because you can just keep killing people.
You can, indeed. Yes, and I always say, it's so much fresher if you don't know who did it, or even who you're going to kill. In The Silver Pigs, the main body occurs a third of the way through, and she is the person who might have been the heroine. So then I was stuck with, I had no women for him to interact with, and decided that the head of the conspiracy he was investigating would be this woman, Helena Justina, and that he would fall for her, and perhaps she would fall for him as well, because that makes for extra tension. But then eventually he'd find out that it was her and she'd fooled him. And if I ever wrote any other books, that would be wonderful. He could be like Mike Hammer, if any of you read the Mike Hammer books. A woman who has deceived and broken his heart and he never gets over it, and that would be Helena. But when I came to the moment where somebody was going to tell him it was her, I couldn't do it, because I am a romantic novelist at heart, and I had written the part of them falling for each other to such a degree that I couldn't bear to have them not live together happily ever after, or with some ructions ever after.
So it made it much less formulaic as well.
Indeed. I would not from choice have had a very low-life character falling for a very high-grade woman. It's too much of a cliche. I would not have done that had I been a planner. But fate steered my arm.
Yes, I must say, listening to you, it isn't very useful for aspiring writers. No, it because isn't really all what you're saying is follow your gut, and the gut had better be a good one in the first place.
And have fun.
Otherwise, you're in trouble. Let's talk about fun. Let's talk about funny, because there's another thing that you get away with that practically nobody else in crime writing does, and that is to be funny without being pigeonholed as, oh, you know, that's the funny author over there. And usually comic books barely sell. We've actually got Christopher Brittmeyer tomorrow, yes, who's funny, and Carl Hyerson. And then there's Janet Ivanovich, who certainly sells. And there are very few people who are allowed to be funny and to write kind of serious mysteries with serious consequences at the same time.
I don't think I've set out to write comic books. There is humour in there because it's the only way I can write. And that's why I'm not actually a romantic novelist, because I did the same with my attempts at romantic novels, and you simply are not allowed to do
Georgia
it.
Georgia Hayes, hilarious.
Yes, I know, but I wanted to write about the English Civil War, and I wanted to include politics seriously, so the combination of the
Blimey, yes, that would have been a lot.
Just was too much for them to cope with. I don't like to be thought of as only a comic writer. I wish people paid more attention to the fact that very serious issues are raised in the Falco novels. And he takes them very seriously. If he's looking at a dead body, he may make a joke about the location and how it's been killed. But he takes very seriously the fact that somebody's life has been taken away early. And he always thinks about the people who are left behind.
And Nemesis, I cried at Nemesis. It's a very, you know, shut up. She was like, last night, she was like, oh,
I kill
sopping.
A child, I'll tell you. If you want to make people cry, just kill a baby. It's just so
I'm sitting there taking notes. And then, if I may say, when I came to read Rebels and Traitors, it wasn't funny.
No, it hardly is funny at all.
It's a very serious book.
Yes.
Did you feel, was it because you have the different protagonists? Because it's not, I don't know who's read Rebels and Traitors, it's third person, different protagonists, very dark. It's a country tearing itself apart.
It's a story I wanted to write about the Civil War. The characters, yes, I hope they're good characters, but in a way the war itself is more important even than the stories that are set against it. And the English Civil War was horrible. It was truly horrible. And one of the things I wanted to show was how horrible it was for people who weren't even in the armies fighting, how wherever you lived. And traditionally, of course, in a book about the English Civil War, you live in a big house, but there is no big house at all worth speaking of in my book. It's about people who lived on streets and lived in cottages, and how you could have your life ripped apart by horrible soldiers without even wanting to take part at all. Or have your life ripped apart by soldiers who you supported, and they'd still come and steal everything you own and kill the maid and rape the woman of the house. So it is a dark book, yes. There are occasional funny scenes. My favourite funny scene is when the heroine thinks her husband is dead, though she can't bring herself to believe it because he's a bit of a pain, frankly, because obviously she can't live with him. She's got to live with the hero, who is somebody else. And while she thinks her husband is dead, she goes to seek advice from a lawyer who says, no, it's perfectly all right, because you haven't heard from your husband for 3 years, and he's generally believed to be drowned at sea. And in the English Commonwealth, another period that I think we ought to know a whole lot more about, they had addressed this. We think of them as being Puritan and horrible, but they had realised that there were lots of women who did not know what had happened to their husband. When a battle occurred, everybody was stripped and just thrown into a grave, and nobody ever bothered to tell the family at home, unless they were lords in finery. And so the country was full of women who didn't know what had happened to their husband and might never find out. So the good legislators in the House of Commons had devised a rule that if you hadn't heard anything for 3 years and you generally thought it reasonable that your husband was dead, you could remarry. And so she does, and of course the next page the husband comes back. But that's just because it's a Lindsay Davis story.
And it's also a Lindsay Davis story, she said, doing a fantastic segue, everyone got that, because it has one of your very classic endings, which are everything has been said, you know everything, but it's quite brutal. You know, yes. It ends on a bit of a bomb explosion,
I have been criticised for this ending. Shall I tell them what it is?
Can you do it without...
Without saying what it is?
We can say it's... I mean, it's... Do you want me to have a go?
No, I'll do it. Okay. It's no good. I'll have to tell you what it is.
Should we take a vote? I don't want...
Yes or no?
No.
No.
I think the no...
The no is louder, but the yes is more. Well, let's try to
camouflage it. Because I do want to talk about her endings. I'm very interested.
The point of it is something really shocking happens. After the war has ended, the Commonwealth is coming to its end. We think that, we know that Oliver Cromwell is going to die and it will all become Charles II and the Restoration. So it's all been in vain. We know that. And I want to say that, and I'm not giving too much away by telling you that. And then something happens to the family we are most focused on, which is shocking and horrendous, and arises out of the war and is another example of how families were devastated by the war, even after it had finished. That's all we'll say.
There you go. So it's, I mean, you don't always want to give the reader the consolation. We talked before about the whole kind of, you know, which I love the Agatha Christie tradition where, you know, everyone's in the library and then, you know, Poirot explains how he worked it out, and it's tremendously satisfying.
And really hard to write. And when I did one with Falco, struth, writing the library scene where they all pop up and say they've done it when they haven't, that was one of the hardest things I've ever
done. Well, you did actually find your own kind of particular take on it by making everyone say they'd done it when they hadn't, which I thought was rather good. But you'll very much respect the intelligence of your readers,
yes,
in that you will say all the clues are there. It's actually reminding me of... it's not 61 hours, a bit before, the Lee Child... Is it 61 hours? Yes, it is. Sorry. 61 hours, where at the end it's kind of... was considered a cliffhanger ending. Does Reacher make it out or doesn't he? And there was a lot of press coverage and people writing and posting and saying
what
you don't make
cheat.
It out.
Don't you think that's a cheat?
And I heard Lee interviewed and he said, really blankly, I had no idea that people were going to remotely think that I would kill Reacher off. Of course I didn't. You know, the next one's out now, so I'm not giving anything away. And he went, I thought there were clearly all the clues and indications in the book to show how he would have made it out of the situation in which he was left at the last one. And I would not, you know, he said, I would not dream of going back and, you know, putting anything else in. I think it's all there in the book. And that's very much your approach.
Yes.
You know, again, without wanting to give anything away, there's the book that I know that people have had problems with you about or have written to you about, because it ends very abruptly in that you don't say, this is the solution.
But
that's where the body is.
I had said it earlier. She's talking about See Delphi and Die, where there are two different strands, one of which isn't a murder, we find out, and Falco explains it. What more do you need? He shows that it isn't a murder, that it was an accident. And he even, in his normal way, expresses sympathy and pity for the family who've been left with a really messy situation. And then there is a serial killer. And at one point he says, it's down to two people. We have to decide between them which one it is. We know how the people have been killed. And throughout the book, there have been references...
Repeated long references
to a Greek myth, to the point that you would think, what is Lindsay doing here, shoving all this Greek myths? She doesn't even like myths, we know that. At the very end, there is a dramatic moment, which I won't give away, except it involves the dog, who everybody loves, and it's fairly horrible, and it's perfectly obvious to me what has happened. Unfortunately, when the book was printed first, it happened at the bottom of a page. And there is an outcry from Helena to tell people not to eat their dinner. You can work the rest out, really. And you turn the page and there's nothing more. And people assumed that there was a printing mistake. In the end, when we had reprints done and other editions, we had to put the end. Still people won't have. What can you do? I will not do jolly scenes like they used to have on Wagon Train where it had all happened and then all the brothers would get together at the end and have a meeting around the campfire. That's not for me.
Do you know, that's what, I don't know if you know a TV series called Numbers, but I actually stopped watching Numbers because there would always be the scene at the end where the father, I'm very good at acting, Judd Hirsch, and he would bond and he and the sons would always be, you know, together, doing a puzzle together or playing bridge and talking about it. It just like, I just couldn't bear, everyone was going to learn and grow and share. And I think when they started Seinfeld, they said there's no learning, there's no growing, there's no sharing, and, you know, that, you'd be quite big on...
I've just got an idea for ending a book with Falco gathering round a board with counters with his children, but perhaps not.
Oh, well, you can do what you want.
I can do what I want. And if I don't like it, I can do another one that's different. That is the wonderful thing about writing a series. If you make a slight historical inaccuracy, which, of course, I never do, you can put it right as soon as you realise what you've done in a future book.
Do people write to you about inaccuracies? I mean, they always seem so.
And I have got a reputation of being horrible for them, which has solved the problem, more or less.
Horrible to them or horrible?
Horrible to them.
Horrible to them, excellent.
Because quite often they are wrong. Occasionally I do something accidentally, but quite often I have carefully researched something and they write in their green ink, if it's a letter, for 7 pages saying, Miss Davis, I don't know how you can have done this. And I've done it because I'm right.
So there.
Well, let me give an example, because that does sound arrogant. I repeatedly get letters, I'm afraid they're mostly from American men, I'm sorry to say this, that say I have
the
made...
The American men in the audience squashed down a little bit.
Yes, all American men who have ever written to me just squashed down. And the ones who haven't, you're fine. Saying Falco would never have gone into the Pantheon in Rome because it was built by the Emperor Hadrian. When the Emperor Hadrian rebuilt it, bigger, it is true, he wrote on the side of it, this building was restored by me, having previously been built by Marcus Agrippa, pre-Falco. It's actually there, written on it, that I am right. I rest my case.
Oh, well, we are sitting, I don't know if everyone can see, you know, the glint of the Cartier diamonds and the top of the diamond dagger, which is very, very fabulous and shiny and pretty and has already made us speculate madly about, you know, different kinds of crime novels that could take place at Crime Fest as people try to nick the dagger repeatedly.
And whether they're real, I'm wondering.
And whether they're real, you know, Swarovski's very shiny. It's hard to tell if we're picking them out.
I do want to say, Lauren, let me say, it is not my intention everywhere I go for the next year or however long they give it me that I will take the diamond dagger and
ask her to bring it. It looks pretty
and
on the
it
table.
It seemed to me, because we have never before been given it, and this is really, it's a CWA dagger, I think, and we are owed many occasions of displaying our trophy, so I thought it was a good moment, as we are actually here for the diamond dagger interview, that it should be present among us.
Now, you've won the diamond dagger, you've won the CWA historical dagger, the dagger, and you've got enough daggers, honestly, to assassinate like 40 people.
So don't cross me.
Wouldn't dream of it. And a Sherlock for Falco as Best Detective. And you've also been given something that I'm not going to pronounce by Zaragoza, and the Premio Colosseo by the City of Rome for burnishing its image in the world.
I take tourists
the
there.
The only people to use totally. I was like, take some kind of discount card, that'd be brilliant. The only other person to win this is Franco Zeffirelli, so it's a very big deal. And it's wonderful, and I'm still aware that generally the people who do win the daggers and do get nominated for awards generally in the crime world tend not to be historical writers. And you're not a cozy writer, but I love cozies, but not to be cozy writers. It does tend to be a certain kind of very dark noir book.
And even if I write a very dark noir book, they will not even shortlist me.
They won't.
I don't think they even read it. They think, those judges, they say, oh, it's won by her. She's done 19 others, throw it in the bin. But
I'm bitter and twisted, obviously.
It is. Well, it's certainly something to be, you know, when they started this, it's the Alice Peters. So I'm not seeing it. Have you not won the Alice
Peters? I was the first winner.
I thought you were the first winner of the Alice
Peters. Maybe there weren't very many entries that time because it was the first time. So maybe I was the only entry.
Well, it's also, in a way, it is a bit of a shame that that's sort of the Alice Peters over there, because what would be great if on the shortlist one would have cosies, you know, every year cosies and noir and historical and a different range of books. Do you think there's a reason? Do you think there's a kind of thinking of that crime writing is a certain way and you don't quite fit into it?
I think that the Alice Peters has had a denigrating effect on the other daggers for historical writers. I think there may be, even if it's subconsciously, a feeling that we don't need to trouble about them because they have their own dagger. That was my worry when it was first mooted that we would have the Alice Peters. And nothing that has happened since has reassured me.
It is a shame because British... I'm so sorry about this cough. I may have a drop somewhere.
While she's having that, let me tell you something about my Zara Gosa
Award. Doesn't really need
me
at all.
No, I don't need her at all, but she's very sweet. I let her come up here because she doesn't get out much, really, and Weatherspoon-seeking boys never approach her, so it's just sad. I'm sorry about that. My prize from the city of Zaragoza, I really love talking about because it's an interesting sideline on how crime novels can sometimes be viewed in other cultures. I don't think it would happen in England. I was invited to go to Zaragoza, and it was deemed by my Spanish publisher to be wonderful. So I toddle off there. And they have two prizes, which I approve of hugely. The first one is for a new novelist, who, of course, was Spanish. And that's a prize which is a huge, strange chunk of rock and €25,000. So they awarded this, and I'm thinking, oh, this is good. And then they come to me, and I get a bigger rock, but no euros at all.
Ooh.
And gradually, well, immediately, it became clear why they were giving me this prize. The mayor of Zaragoza had made it his mission to get his city made a European city of culture. And he thought that if he awarded me a prize, he could persuade me to write a Falco novel set in Roman Zaragoza. And to help me, I was taken on a day-long tour of archaeological sites in that city. And people kept saying, wouldn't it be wonderful if you wrote a Falco novel set in...
They could have bunged you some money as well, I'm sorry.
Well, the money was the way they should have gone, obviously. They completely failed to understand how I work. I was nonplussed, I have to say, and the rock was so heavy I had to leave it behind.
She had to bring the Premio Colosseo away from Rome wrapped in her socks.
Yes, that was too big to go in my hand luggage in its beautiful satin box. So I put the satin box in the suitcase, and the Premio is long and thin, so it just was calling out to be put in a woolly sock, wasn't it? I carried it through security in my hand luggage thinking, when this goes through the X-ray machine, questions will be asked. I was ready. I had the invitation letter from the mayor of Rome. And, of course, nobody asked anything at all, which raises questions in my mind.
And talking about questions, get me. I will take questions. We don't have a microphone, but if you put your hand up and say it, I will repeat it into mine for the audience. So, lady at the front.
I've read all of the Falco books.
Thank you.
They're very detailed in exactly how he gets across Rome in all sorts of ways. Do you have a sort of 3D model at home or a computer model? It's so baffling how he knows which temples he's going past and not which.
He has a map.
Let me just... very good question. Lindsay describes Rome so well and so clearly that it's as if... Does she have a 3D model on her computer or some way to actually recreate where Falco is going? When you're describing Rome particularly.
No, he just has a map, and I went to a good school where they taught me I can actually direct drivers when I'm in the passenger seat from a map, which many women are deemed to be incapable of doing, perhaps wrongly sometimes.
So no bitterness there.
So I can read a map, and there are now 3D models, and you can go to Rome, especially I recommend you to go to 3D Rome Rewind, I think it's called, which is very near the Colosseum and which has the most wonderful presentation of Rome as a 3D image. But I work in two dimensions. One of the things that I did get wrong in my first draft was that I don't have a good sense of scale. So when my book was accepted by Oliver, he said, having made a mistake with some previous thriller, that I had to go to Rome and see for myself, because I'd written both Course of Honour and The Silver Pigs without going. And I did find that it was much bigger than I had anticipated. And so I had Falco going in all directions on foot, as he has to, and he couldn't have done it, tough though he is. So that's a reason to physically go there. But I think imagination is something that an author has to have. A lot of archaeology is nothing but a pattern of stones on the ground, and you have to yourself imagine what it would have been like in 3D, and then persuade people that you're right. Maybe I am not always right about that, but the job is to convince.
Other questions? Paul.
Why did you choose that particular period of Roman imperial history, either imperial or republican, which you didn't choose?
Why did Lindsay choose that particular period of Roman history to write about?
It all goes back to my Vespasian story. When I was trying to be a romantic novelist or to write a love story, I found that. And it wasn't immediately, The Course of Honour was not immediately published. In fact, it wasn't published for 10 years. So I'd done the research into that period and had got to the moment where Vespasian becomes emperor. And when I started to write the Falco series, it was all in my head. So I just took up from there. It's a very good period in many ways, because a lot of the surviving Latin literature is from the first century, a lot of really good archaeology, including Pompeii, of course, it is from that period. I liked having, for my private eye, the tension between him as a republican and the fact that there was an emperor. So it all just fell into place, really.
Will there be another break with Falco, like Rebels and Traitors, and do you plan to do something historically in a different vein sometime in the near future?
Will there be another break with Falco as Lindsay took writing Rebels and Traitors, and does she plan to do something else historical in the near future?
Well, my current book, which is just being edited, is not a Falco novel, though that is...
Do you have a title? Yes,
it's called Master and God. Don't you think that's good? That's what Domitian called himself, outraging everybody, because a Roman could be master, but he couldn't be a god. So that's a break in a way, because it's a different period.
Wasn't Caesar a god, though? Didn't Caesar make himself
a god?
Yes,
you could be made a god after you're dead. You cannot say, I am a god walking around among you, lie down and lick my boots. That's a different thing altogether. Immodest. I would like to write something, maybe not the Civil War, because I feel I'm Civil War'd out, probably. Rebels and Traitors is really, really long, and it will be a long time before I want to go back to that. But it is all to be discussed. You have to remember that publishers are very wary of a person who's written 20 books in one period and then says they want to do something else. And the decision about what you write, this goes back to, will there be another Falco? It's not entirely my decision. I have to persuade somebody to buy the book. So that is quite a complex process sometimes.
Yes, I think we probably all feel that you could twist somebody's arm there, not utterly unsuccessfully.
I still have to get it right before I start twisting.
I think I'll take two more questions and then we'll wrap up. So Janet and Max, and Janet, why don't you go first?
Lindsay, I remember going to a talk you gave at, I think it was a Nottingham conference, where you explained your sources and talked about the various primary writings of that period and what you'd taken out of them. Tell me, after 20 books, are you still finding new things in your sources, or do you know them all so well now?
No, there's always new things. Janet is asking me about sources and whether after 20 books I can still use the same Latin sources. There are always new passages, or passages I never had read in the first place. And certainly for the latest book, I used people I'd never used. There's a poet called Statius, who I think writes ghastly stuff, but he's very highly regarded in the classical community. And I had great fun introducing Statius as a character and having my Praetorian guard, who does not mince his words, saying, Statius, he must be taking the piss. Which I wait to see how the classical community take that.
And, OK, Maxim, and then you, and then we'll finish.
Before you started writing crime stories set in ancient Rome, there were barely one or two isolated examples, not even series. But since you've been writing and the success you've had, we're having a lot of, I would say, imitators, but other people writing about Rome or Rome in different periods. Without naming names, what are some of the things that irritate you most?
Oh, boy.
The fact that many of them are no good. Without naming names. I think the ones that were around, including Stephen Saylor, who's here at this conference, I do respect, because, first of all, they thought of it for themselves. They are not jumping on the Lindsay Davis Falco bandwagon. And they are good. But there, everywhere you look, there are people popping up. And, indeed, only last week, some publisher bought three novels by an Oxford University undergraduate. What can they know about life and death, I ask myself. It's as if you can do anything so long as it's set in the first century, as often as not. Not even, although the Roman Empire is 500 years long and the Republic is even longer. It's all tied down sometimes even to the AD 70s, which I bag. I had such fun writing something that was innovative and original, and I feel very sad that young writers, new writers, don't see that possibility is there, and the possibility to make your own mark and to do your own thing and do something that is completely different and yours.
Lovely.
Sad.
Would you mind very much sharing your educational background with us?
What is Lindsay's educational background?
Well, I have shared it in the Falco Companion. It's no secret. I was born in Birmingham to middle-class people whose ancestors were working class, absolutely. So I went to an English primary school. I then went to what was called a direct grant school, which is now a private school, as we call them, a public school, I think. Yes. And so I had a classical education at secondary level. And then by doing Latin so that I didn't lose it, I managed to go to Oxford University in the days when the entrance exam included a translation from Latin. I'm hopeless at Latin. But I kept it up enough to go, and I read English language and literature, which I would advocate any writer should choose as their degree subject.
And we are actually going to end here, but Lindsay is going to read us a valediction in Latin.
Yes. This is Lauren has asked me to do this, so don't blame me, please. It was part of dealing with Monsieur Bomberger of Cartier. It had become a tradition that people who won the dagger did address him in French, as he is French, and he speaks in a cod French accent, which can't
be real.
I did
wonder why you were speaking in French to him.
Yes, so I did do a bit of French. I had to liaise with a French teacher on the other side of the Atlantic to get that right. And then I thought, I've always refused to sign books in Latin or to do anything in Latin because I am hopeless at it, and it seems wrong for me to do so. But just to enliven the occasion, I thought I'll do a bit in Latin. And then he did make the mistake of saying to me in his preamble, did I speak Italian, to which I had to say no. So he was starting to look snooty and foreign. So all the more reason, therefore, for me to do a bit in Latin. And I hope you will recognise what part of it is. I think actually on the night people didn't. It starts off with a bit of me saying, Marcus Didius Falco Romanus est. Lingua Latina sibi est et hodie mihi. Falco cognoscat. And this is a bit you ought to recognise. Per has via sordidas viri eundum est. Id est via nec ignobilis ipse, nec infuscatus, nec timidus. In fabulis huius modi, delator via huius modi necesse est. Heros est, totus est, and it is Daniels mean streets, of course.
Thank you very much, Lindsay. It's been a great interview.